morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this May 7th. Our guest this hour asks us in a recent piece in the New York Times to consider two children, one from a family with an income of $165,000 and one from a family with income of $15,000, the 90th and 10th percentiles of the income distribution nationally. 10% of children today grow up in families with incomes below $15,000. 10% grow up in families with incomes above $165,000. In the 1980s, he writes, on an 800-point SAT-type test scale, the average difference in test scores would have been about 90 points. Today, it is 125 points, almost twice as large as the 70-point test score gap between white and black children. Family income, Sean Reardon writes, is now a better predictor of children's success in school than race. Sean Reardon is a professor of education and sociology at Stanford University and specializes in research on the effects of educational policy on educational and social inequality. His primary research examines the relative contribution of family, school, and neighborhood environments to racial, ethnic, and socioeconomic disparities. The article that appeared in the New York Times Weekly Review section April 27 caught our attention. No Rich Child Left Behind. And Professor Reardon is our guest this hour. We'll be welcoming phone calls. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Professor Sean Reardon, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, very, very interesting article. What's new here, you say, is that over the last few decades in this country, the differences between high and low income students have grown, and they have grown rather substantially, haven't they?
That's right. Yeah, I mean, there's always been gaps in academic outcomes between children from high and low income backgrounds, but they're much bigger now than they were 30 years ago.
And the academic gap is widening because rich students are increasingly entering kindergarten very prepared to succeed in school. How so?
Yeah, so if you look at sort of school readiness tests given to kindergartners when they enter school at age 5 or 6, there used to be relatively small differences between high-income and middle-income students and big differences between middle-income and low-income students. But now the gaps between the high and the middle-income students are as big or bigger even than the gaps between the middle and the low-income students.
Because they're taking test preparation classes or
well,
what?
Probably not, though one hears stories of some of that. But I think what's happening is that increasingly children in high-income families are getting better child care, better access to high-quality preschool. Their parents are doing a lot of cognitively stimulating activities with them, reading to them, taking them to, you know, museums, sort of talking to them a lot. They hear a lot of vocabulary. And while all parents, when you look at the data, middle-class, low-income, and high-income parents are all sort of doing more of that stuff with their kids, high-income families are doing a lot more of it and have been increasing the rate at which they do it much faster over the last few decades.
Mm-hmm. You also talk about this same pattern. We can look at other measures of educational success, like college completion, and find that rich students are also doing much better.
Yeah, if you look at the proportion of kids who go to college or complete a college, or at the proportion who go to sort of the most selective schools, the Ivy Leagues, the state flagship institutions like the University of Wisconsin, for example, the proportion of kids from high-income families who go to those schools is about 15% of a graduating class. The proportion of middle-class kids who go to those schools is about 5% of a graduating class, and of low-income students, it's about 2 or 3%. So there's a big difference between the middle and the high-income kids and their rates at which they go to those most selective schools.
And that's quite a change for the elite public schools in this country. They become schools that more rich people go to now. It used to be just about everybody of a lot of different income levels could go to those schools, right?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't looked closely at the difference between the sort of elite privates and the elite public schools, but that's certainly the story you hear. Partly it's because states have been providing less public funding for the state institutions, and they've relied more on private funding and more on tuition. And so as tuition has gone up, and they've gotten more competitive in terms of admission requirements. They've moved to have a sort of a more upper income student population.
Tell me how important school is to economic success in America.
So it's always been somewhat important, but it's a lot more important now. If you look at sort of earnings data and sort of say how much do people with college degrees earn relative to how much do people with just a high school diploma earn, the difference back in the 50s and 60s wasn't that great because it was possible to earn a solid middle class wage with just a high school diploma working in manufacturing, automobile plants, steel industry, textile mills, a lot of sort of high-wage professions that didn't require more than a high school diploma. A lot of those jobs are gone, and the economy has changed, and so what economists call the wage premium, the sort of how much extra you earn for having a college degree, has increased a lot. And so having a college degree matters a lot more in terms of your life earnings than it used to.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
And I think, that fact isn't lost on parents, right? So if you're thinking about your child and you want them to have a successful life and earn a good living, you want them to go to college. And then you start to think a lot more about school and how important school is. And so I think we've seen lots of increased attention to schooling among parents, even among young children. I think that contributes to some of this increased early childhood attention.
Are there legitimate questions, Professor Reardon, about whether or not the rich have gone over the top in preparing their children for good lives, scheduling them? We've heard some people, you go to ballet, you go to soccer, you go to a special reading class, you go to learn Chinese, whatever it is, and you're essentially missing being a child.
Well, I mean, you certainly hear people worry about whether or not there's too much focus on structure and activity and all sorts of things in early childhood, and kids don't get to sort of just go out and play in the yard like they used to. I'm not a developmental psychologist, so what the long-term impacts of one kind of child rearing or another on sort of happiness and things like that are, I can't say. But the fact that the children of the rich are sort of doing much better in school than the middle class shouldn't, I don't think our response should be, well, let's have the rich do less with their kids. I mean, I think what we should do is figure out how to provide the same kind of opportunities for middle class kids and low income kids as the rich are able to provide for their kids, so that everyone can sort of enter school with that same high level of school readiness and preparedness to sort of thrive in school and in life.
So you write that we really should take a lesson from the rich and invest more heavily as a society in early childhood education, high-quality child care, making sure we have skilled preschool teachers. You know, what struck me as I read the article was that how much that all of those recommendations seem to be kind of off the table. We used to be talking about that a lot more 10 years ago.
Well, I think, things come and go from the policy agenda. I mean, certainly President Obama has put early childhood education back on the agenda. He, in his State of the Union address and his budget proposals, he and Arne Duncan have suggested the federal government invest $75 billion, I think, over the next 10 years in helping states develop better systems of early child care or early preschool for kids. And I think so it's back on the agenda, at least in this administration. And I think the word, that they use is invest in this, which I think is the right way to think about it, because there's a lot of research that shows that, every dollar invested in high-quality early childhood education pays off in societal benefits down the road, fourfold, sevenfold, 17-fold. People have different numbers for how much it is, but it's always a big payback. And if you were an investor, you would like a 4-fold increase on your money or a 7-fold increase on your money. So I think, I think from an investing in our kids' future standpoint, it's a kind of a no-brainer from a financial point of view. It's a, there's a political challenges to it, but I think from a what would be good for our kids, there's not a lot of controversy about it.
What about high-quality child care, Professor Reardon? Are we lacking in that regard in this country?
Well, I mean, I think high-income families are able to provide high-quality child care for their kids. You have a lot of families with two working parents, but they're able to pay for good child care, nannies or preschool centers that, you know, provide lots of developmentally appropriate, cognitively stimulating kind of activities and whatnot. What we don't have is kind of a good system everywhere for providing low-income and, to some extent, middle-income families with access to those same kind of things. As a country, we don't spend a whole lot of our education dollars or our federal budget on early childhood compared to lots of other developed countries that spend a lot bigger share of their education budget in the early childhood years. So I don't think we have as well developed a system for the sort of bottom half of the income distribution.
Mm. Are there certain countries we ought to be looking at that could serve as models?
I'm sure there are, but the cross-national stuff is not my area of expertise, so I wouldn't know which ones exactly we should look at.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do we do about high-quality child care? When we invest in it, we are talking about people who run high-quality centers. How do we go about investing in that? We have to train people in order to understand early childhood development. It's a tall order.
Yeah, I mean, I think we need to do a better job of training teachers, both for K-12 and for preschool, and thinking about systems where states can develop systems of credentialing early child care providers and preschool teachers, and making sure that they have the kind of developmental training that's appropriate, that so that they sort of know how to work with young children. And that's, we don't have great systems in place for that. Some states have been putting in place systems to measure the quality of child care and the quality of preschools, and I think that's a step in the right direction. But I think the training is an area, not just in preschool, but throughout K-12, where we need to do a better job in our colleges of training people to be good teachers.
Mm-hmm. The benefits from early education and from having all of that available to you are how long lasting? Do they last through elementary school or through high school?
Well, it depends the benefits on what. So if you look at kids' test scores, a lot of the studies find that there are benefits to going to high quality preschool or Head Start or things like that, but that the test score effects sort of fade out, but that other effects on kind of what they call non-cognitive skills, behavioral skills, and other kinds of social behaviors, that those things last a long time and end up paying off in terms of kids getting in less trouble when they're teenagers, higher rates of going to college, lower rates of crime and violence and arrest and incarceration, all sorts of things like that last a long time. But some of the test score benefits sort of fade out, and that makes some people think, oh, well, these preschool doesn't really matter because the test score gains don't last. But test scores aren't the only thing we care about, of course, with our kids, and a lot of the benefits do last for a long time.
Mm-hmm. You also write in the article about finding ways of helping parents become better teachers themselves. How do we do that?
Well, I mean, I think one way that every parent wants their child to thrive and wants to be a good parent. And what limits some parents from doing that is the stress of trying to sort of hold down a job or two jobs and pay the rent and mm-hmm. make sure there's food on the table. And so we could do a better job of providing sort of support systems for families so that they had the kind of time and mental space to be able to focus more on their kids and less on the anxieties of kind of daily survival. But I think we also, you know, can help parents, you know, learn more about what's developmentally beneficial for kids. So there have been some programs that have helped particularly low-income mothers develop good parenting skills, like the Nurse Family Partnership is a program that sends a nurse to the house of first-time low-income moms to help them both with kind of, you know, nutrition and medical advice and taking care of the kids, but also to provide some kind of parenting information to help them think about how to be a good parent. And those programs have been shown to have long-lasting benefits. The children who grew up in the families that got the Nurse Family Partnership Program do much better in school and in all kinds of social and behavioral outcomes well into adolescence and early adulthood. And so programs like that that are relatively low cost relative to their benefits have lots of long-term benefits because they help parents sort of do the job that parents want to do better, but by giving them some information and some skills. And I think thinking about how to expand some of those models to maybe not in quite as intrusive a ways, because not everyone needs someone to come to the home, but to figure out how to help parents kind of do better parenting would be a great benefit.
Are there many such nurse family partnerships, or are those programs few and far between?
Well, they've been developed starting, I think, in the 1980s and have been studied for a long time. And the Obama administration in its first term made expansion of those programs a priority. I haven't seen the numbers on sort of how much they've expanded and how prevalent they are, but certainly there's been a push in the last few years to do more of that. But I don't know how extensive they are.
Mm-hmm. And I think one of the key elements here also is time, isn't it? You mentioned families, and there are many of them who have to work two jobs, or they're working an overnight shift, and they have to get daycare for their children overnight, and then they have to sleep during the day. When we're looking at this issue, we also have to look at the economy and the availability, or lack thereof, of jobs that pay decently.
Right. I mean, if you're a single mom, or if you're a two-parent family and you're working minimum-wage jobs, a minimum-wage job, you know, doesn't pay a lot, and you might have to work two jobs or a lot of overtime in order to have enough to pay the rent, put food on the table, pay the medical bills, and so on. And so it's hard to have the amount of time to spend with your kids, to do, you know, to read to them, to engage in all sorts of activities with them if you don't have that much time. So there's some interesting research that looks at how much time parents have spent with their children over the last 40 years. And the good news is everyone's spending more time with their kids, more time than they did on average 40 years ago. But the most highly educated families are spending twice as much more time now as the less educated parents are, partly because, I think, of the constraints of having to work long hours if you're low income, but partly also because I think there's a lot of attention on young children now in our society, and so highly educated parents are very conscious of how important education is and spend a lot of time with their kids to try to get them kind of ready for school.
We welcome phone calls. Our guest this hour is Sean Reardon, professor of education and sociology at Stanford University. He wrote a piece, No Rich Child Left Behind, which is in the April 27 New York Times Weekly Review section. We've posted his article on our Facebook page. If you would like to read it, it's highly interesting. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We welcome phone calls now on your thoughts about all of this, the children of the rich performing better in school on average than children from middle class or poor families. And it's not just better, it is substantially better. Our guest says what's new is that in this country over the last few decades, the differences in education success between high and low income students have grown, and they've grown substantially. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, lines are open for you right now. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now for Professor Sean Reardon, and our calls start with Sally in Alma. Hi, Sally.
Hi there. I think the major discrepancy between the achievement level, I do agree with him partially that I think naturally if you have a lot of money you can do a lot of economic advantages to the child, but I think it's the mentality of the parents and the value system because, you know, I'm probably mispronouncing her name, but look at the justice of the Supreme Court. Is it Sotomayor or something? You know who I mean. The last
Sotomayor,
lady that was
yeah.
You can correct me. But she grew up in the slums of the Bronx, and she went to the Catholic school system for the grammar school and the high school. But because she had a mother who was, she was a nurse, but she did grow up in the slums, she became, look, she's the justice of the Supreme Court because the mother instilled values for education. And then another example is Colin Powell. He grew up in that, you know, housing development that was just terrible, and yet he went to one of the state university schools, and look at all he accomplished in his life. And then the one that I do admire, and I can't remember his name, and you would know his name, it was the black doctor that was the head of Johns Hopkins, and he just wrote a book last year, I believe. And his mother didn't even have, she couldn't even read, and she would make the brother and he sit down and read books, and then they had a book report, and she would take a pencil, and even though she couldn't reach it, actually act like she didn't, she'd go over and start marking it and stuff, and she didn't even know what she was doing. But she valued education for her children. My father died when I was 12, and my mother was left with three children, 12, 13, and 14. And I'm an older woman, and we were raised with self-reliance, and we were also raised with a sense of responsibility. Not that the government is supposed to do everything for us.
Okay. Thank you, Sally. We have a lot of calls, so you've made important points. Professor Reardon.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are certainly examples, and lots of them, of people who started out in relatively low-income or disadvantaged families and have achieved very high levels of success. There are just vastly more examples of people who started out in high-income families and achieved lots of success. And I think it's not, although a lot of people sort of ask me, sort of, is it because there are different values among low-income parents and high-income parents? None of the evidence suggests that the values are really different. If you look at surveys of parents who have young children and you ask them what they want for their child and how important education is and how far they want their child to go in school, there's no difference between the high and low-income kids. In fact, black parents often have slightly higher average responses on those than white parents. That is, they want more college, more education for their kids. So I don't think the problem is really a different valuing of education. I think it's different opportunities.
Thanks, Sally, for your call. Let's go to Peg in the Oxford area. Hi, Peg.
Hi.
Hi.
I have certifications, early childhood special ed in K-9, and a master's in curriculum instruction. And from all those years working in the area of the higher education for educators, I think one of our big problems is that we're not attracting the really good candidates to the early childhood area of certification. The money is at high school. The money is not in teaching early childhood ed. As important as it is, it does not seem to be valued.
Professor Reardon, I think she's right.
I think she's right, too. I mean, I said earlier that I thought we needed to do more to train teachers for early childhood, but I think we need to attract more people to that. If we're going to have more and better preschool and child care centers, we're going to need to attract a lot more people and a lot more people who are going to be very good teachers. And so making it a more highly paid and highly respected profession is going to help us do that.
Mm-hmm. And do you see any evidence that we're moving toward that?
Not yet, but you know, there's a lot of people talking about that we need to move in that direction, and to the extent talk is a precursor to action, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Peg, for the call. Jeff in River Falls. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a retired school psychologist and worked with a lot of kids across the economic spectrum. And when I was in school back in the 70s, I studied a Burton White who did a lot of research in kids 1 to 3. And the point that he made that I think played out throughout my career was that those are critical years that are never made up for. And when we get kids who come into school with extremely poor medical care or no medical care, or the mother had poor medical care before they were born, they're at a disadvantage that they never catch up. And it seems to me that the medical part of it is key in an awful lot of these kids. You know, you mentioned Colin Powell and people like that. Those are great examples, and I've seen them myself. But those are exceptions, and my guess is he had great medical care. His mother had good medical care, and he was born sound and normal and got a lot of support from parents who cared. And that's, like you say, that's an exception when you're dealing with economic struggles like we are. But it seems like the medical piece is a big part of it.
Yeah, I would completely agree. I mean, to the extent that kids grow up without health insurance and don't get great medical care, that just adds to the sort of disadvantage and makes it harder for them to achieve.
Thanks, Jeff, for your call. We have lines open for you if you'd like to join our conversation. No Rich Child Left Behind is what we're talking about this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We've talked a little bit about government support, and we'll talk more about this. You also say that we need greater business support for maternity and paternity leave and for daycare. I would have thought that businesses by now would have realized it's in their economic best interest to do just that, and that there would have been terrific daycare centers flourishing all in cities and in places all over the country to make it easier for parents so they could be better employees as well. And I don't see much sign of that happening.
Yeah, I haven't seen good data on the extent of that, but certainly anecdotally one hears that there's more of that now than there was maybe 20 or 30 years ago, but still not a whole lot of it. And so, you know, I think it's certainly in companies' best interest to have high quality childcare available for their employees, if not on site, you know, near site, because then parents can kind of get over to take care of any problem that might arise quickly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think that would be helpful, but I don't know to what extent companies are moving in that direction.
Do they get tax breaks? Do we need some kind of big tax break plan, or what would move companies to do that?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I am probably not the best person to answer it because I don't know the regulations on that, and I don't quite know how the tax law works on that.
Diane in Milwaukee, our next caller. Hi, Diane.
I agree with the guy about the medical care. That's really important. But another thing that's very important is the nutrition of the child after birth and of the mother before birth. If you don't have enough nutrition and the right kinds of foods, the brain doesn't grow. There were studies in England where they gave kids vitamin-packed snacks in kindergarten and raised their IQ. So we have to teach people. And go look at the grocery store prices now. You can't buy an apple. I don't know how people with two or three children buy fruit for their children. We need to do something about raising the minimum wage or helping people to be able to afford good nutrition, not just hamburger.
I totally agree with the caller's point as well. Certainly prenatal care, prenatal nutrition, and early and, you know, high quality nutrition throughout kids' lives matters. And there's been some studies where they've looked at the benefits of kids getting a free breakfast at school, and that has a huge effect on their school performance, because if you come to school hungry, it's very hard to focus on your schoolwork.
Thanks, Diane. Carl in Madison, hi.
Yes, hello. I'm a former kindergarten teacher, and recently received a PhD in curriculum instruction here in Wisconsin. I've read a lot of research. One researcher saying we've long known everything we need to know to educate all students to a high standard. The issue is whether we have the will and put the financial resources in place to do so. And in the research that I've read, I mean, everything from John Dewey 100 years ago going forward, how to engage students and how to move them forward is not a big mystery. It's really more a matter of the political will and then the economic resources and the support for the kind of quality teaching and the kind of respect for the profession that needs to be in place before you're going to see students achieve. And we're talking about kids coming to school, you know, hungry. These are issues that I agreed with an earlier caller. If you're going to talk about it and lament it, then put some economic resources behind it and really put it at the forefront of who we are as a nation and what matters to us.
And Carl, from your studies of this, was there a time in American history when we did that, and how far are we from doing that now?
Well, actually, I was in Italy looking at a school that is the early childhood programs in Reggio Emilia, Italy. And they say, you know, we're doing powerful things. Newsweek listed them as one of the 10 greatest school systems in the world. And they said, everything we got from your American researchers. We got from John Dewey. You have all of these wonderful people who have rich and powerful ideas and who study teachers doing work in the field that matters and tremendous examples. You just don't know who they are and you don't follow them yourselves. We're reading your researchers, following their work and doing powerful stuff with it.
And what's that powerful stuff?
That stuff is the engagement of the child and the teacher, the natural interest and curiosity of the child, and then the teacher working to feed that through connecting their interests and their what drives their curiosity to larger bodies of knowledge, ever-increasing circles of awareness of the world around you. And that dance back and forth requires a fairly small teacher-to-student ratio. It requires a teacher who is respected and has the education background and the community support to move forward boldly with the students in their class. And it also requires that the relationship remain organic, that it not be a state-mandated rubber stamp, everybody in every classroom doing the same thing, but values and honors that relationship in the classroom, that if a child brings something in or has a story to tell from early childhood on up, that they feel that they matter and are valued in the classroom, and that relationship, that dance back and forth between the teacher and the student, becomes this powerful motor. Look at a five-year-old, and you'll see excitement and energy and drive, and you look at them by third grade, and one educator says you have to wonder what it is we're doing to these kids.
Hmm. Send us more, Carl. This would be an interesting follow-up show for us. Professor Reardon.
Well, a lot of interesting points, and I would agree there's a lot of research that doesn't sort of make it into policy, and we know a lot about good teaching. I think the question of political will is an interesting one, and there's a little way in which I'm hopeful that something is different now about the political will, and that's this. Historically, a lot of our conversation about inequality in education has sort of focused on the fact that the poor and children from low-income families are relatively disadvantaged and sort of not doing as well as the middle class. And so there was a kind of a set of policies and a conversation about how can we help the poor. And that was easier when in the 60s when budgets were high and economic growth was big. And then as the economy tightens, there's sort of less and less interest in that. But now, because these gaps are really widening between high income and, mm-hmm. and everyone else, that the conversation isn't so much maybe a conversation about how can we help the poor, but a conversation among the middle class about how can we make sure that we're not falling behind? What can we do, and what kind of policies would help everyone achieve at the levels of the high income? And that the shift from a kind of conversation about the poor to a conversation about the middle class might change some of the political will. I don't know that it will, but I think it seems to me it's a slightly different conversation.
Mm. What do you think of that, Carl?
Well, I think that if you study how people in wealthy communities educate their children, the teacher-to-student ratio, the resources available, the honor for the teacher within the community, and then you look at the way in which we mandate children in poverty, the kinds of education opportunities they receive, the state-directed, very top-down, skill-and-drill kind of education, they are fundamentally different education systems. And it's not that poor children of color can't achieve or get excited by the kind of education that is available to wealthy students. It's just that they don't have access to it. The children from wealthy families who send their children to schools where, you know, the teacher has a high level of education and also is compensated at a reasonable rate and also has the freedom to really follow that relationship and that dialogue between the child and the student, the child has a great deal more autonomy in the classroom and a great deal more power in the classroom in an affluent teaching environment, because the parents want for their child to be advocates and to have a strong voice. And then you look at the way in which we mandate educational opportunities or lack of them for children in poverty, they're fundamentally different teaching experiences and fundamentally different learning opportunities.
Mm-hmm. What happens, though, Professor Reardon? It strikes me that what we're looking at is maybe segregated systems here, too, not just in terms of race, which we're seeing in public schools, certainly in this city we are, but if you're allowing a certain group of people, those who have a lot of money, to have all these great educational experiences, then poor kids aren't having those experiences. So what kinds of values are you teaching the rich kids if you're having them all be together and be successful?
Well, yeah, one of the things we've found is that the extent to which neighborhoods and schools are segregated by income has grown a lot in the last 40 years. The schools and neighborhoods are still more segregated by race than by income, but racial segregation has been slowly declining. over the last few decades, whereas income segregation has been going up rapidly. And so increasingly, higher-income kids are living in neighborhoods and going to school with mostly other high-income kids, and lower-income kids are mostly going to school and living in neighborhoods with low-income schools. And so I think there's lots of reasons to worry about the consequences of that, not just for education, but sort of for broader social understanding of other people, of empathy, so I think that's a bigger problem even than education, I think.
Yeah. Thanks, Carl, very much for your interesting call. Let us know more about Italy, and we'll investigate that for a show. We're talking with Professor Sean Reardon, Professor of Education and Sociology at Stanford University. We reference an article that he wrote that we read and said, oh, let's do a show on this. April 27, New York Times Weekly Review. It's on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and it looks at the children of the rich performing better in school on average than children from the middle class or poor families, and that this is getting more and more pronounced as the years have gone by. So why are educational disparities growing, and what is it we can do to make sure that when you go to school, you got the same kind of chance of being a smart, caring, fully developed human being as somebody who has a lot of money? 800, our number is 800-486-8655. Our lines have been busy, so you can always write us a note if you'd like, and that's WPR.org or on the Facebook page, and we'll get to some of those as well. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, a recent report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention found that nearly 1 in 5 high school age boys in this country have been diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. That number seemed pretty high to us, so we thought, let's do a show on this. Professor William Graff, who's a professor of pediatrics and neurology at Yale School of Medicine, will join us hour two. Back to phone calls for Professor Sean Reardon, and we go to Rick in Bellevue next. Hi, Rick.
Hi, great show. My wife's an educator, and she's taught in various different socioeconomic schools. Some are very poor, some are very affluent, and we've had many discussions on this. And the factor that no one seems to be talking about is parental involvement. Children that have parents that are involved in their educational experience do well. Children that don't do not do well, regardless of their socioeconomic background. It is her opinion, and she's, like I said, been various schools where she has offered to go visit parents at their homes because they didn't have a car or they couldn't make it, and had been turned down to meet in any way, shape, or form, have any sort of communication because they simply did not value the educational experience of their child. I understand that, you know, it is a very bad situation for many people, that they're poor, they can't afford a lot of things, but there are many, many administrators, many, many educators who are willing to go the extra step to make sure they get the educational experience, and there's some disengagement. If you grew up and went to college, there's a pretty good chance you're going to want your child to go to college. If you grew up and did not see the value in education, there's a pretty good chance you might not see the value of education, irregardless and irrespective of what you put down on a survey. I was like the guest's thoughts on that. Now,
all right. Thanks, Rick. Thanks for the call.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's hard to adjudicate between sort of how much is different valuing of education and how much is different comfort or familiarity or ability to kind of engage with school. So if you're a struggling parent who's having trouble keeping, you know, food on the table and stuff, you might not want a teacher who is in a sort of higher status position than you in society sort of showing up at your house, because it might feel judgmental, it might feel threatening, it might feel embarrassing. So I'm wary of sort of attributing differences in parental involvement to differences in values. It's not to say that different people in society don't have different values, but all of the evidence suggests that valuing of education has gone up over time, and it's equally high among families with different socioeconomic and different racial backgrounds. What's different, I think, is the familiarity with the educational system. If you've been very successful in school, then it's much more comfortable to walk into the school and talk to the teacher, because school is a comfortable place where you did well. If you didn't do well in school, had a bad experience, then it's less comfortable to walk into school and engage with the teacher or the principal. And so it's more complicated than simply values. I think it's a complicated interaction between status and comfort and past experience and things like that.
We've had a couple emails asking for you to comment on the voucher system, which, of course, started here in this area quite a few years ago as a way for poor children to have a somewhat similar education as rich children. It was sold that way. Would you like to comment on the voucher system and private schools?
Yeah, well, only to the extent to say that I think that's a sort of different kind of question. I don't think private schooling is a big part of the reason why this disparity between high and low income kids have grown, and I think that for two reasons. One is this disparity has grown in early childhood before kids get to school, and so we can't attribute that part of the story to private versus public schooling. And secondly, the rates of private schooling haven't changed much over time. Back in the 50s and 60s, private school rates were higher because a lot of kids went to Catholic school. Fewer kids go to Catholic school now, and about 10% of children nationally go to private school, and that's been pretty stable for the last 30 or so years. So there it's not like there's more children going to private school or more high-income children going to private school now. So I don't think the private school issue and the voucher issues that go along with that are part of the reason why we see the widening gap in academic outcomes between high and middle-income kids. Now, we could have a different conversation about vouchers, but for purposes of this conversation,
right,
I don't think they're part of the story.
Right. That's another story. We'll get to it on another show. Flora in the Wisconsin Dells. Hi.
Hi. I've got a master's degree in early childhood leadership and advocacy. So I'd like to go back and digress in the conversation. In Illinois, the fact that early childhood teachers get paid so little, had a business, a child care business, for 29 years. And at one point, I had three child care centers in three different cities in Illinois. And at one point, the state of Illinois had a program called Great Start, which to me was an incredible boon because we don't pay our teachers enough, and quite honestly, there's not enough in the budget to do it. But Great Start rewarded teachers for continuing their education. So, for instance, I had a set of twins that worked for me, and they both had their master's degrees. And on top of what they earned, they could apply twice a year, and they got about $3,000 a year from the state of Illinois as a bonus for continuing to take classes. And then down to the minimally qualified teacher, which is 30 credit hours, this is in the state of Illinois, with 1,560 hours of experience. They could make up to $1,000 a year by applying for this grant as long as they stayed in school and could show evidence of a good academic standing. So I think that it would behoove the nation to do something like that for early childhood teachers, since the average parent cannot afford the true cost of child care, and therefore the child care centers cannot afford the true cost of child care. So, and then I wanted to also touch on Maria Montessori and her teachings. They should be so widely accepted across, because it is just simply a matter of common sense. Teach the children what they want to learn.
Thank you so much, Flora, for the call.
Yeah, but great points. I think we need to do more to professionalize early childhood education, as well as to professionalize the teaching profession more generally, and that means ongoing professional development. It means higher pay. It means more time for teachers and early childhood educators to kind of work together and exchange ideas, all the sort of things professionals do in other careers. And so I would agree with the caller on all of those points.
Mm. We also haven't spent very much time, and I find this interesting. You write about the widening income disparity. Not a result, I don't think this is commonly known, Professor, of widening racial gaps in achievement. Gaps between blacks and whites and Hispanic and non-Hispanic whites have been narrowing slowly, albeit slowly, but they have been narrowing over the last two decades.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think one of the the stories is that if you looked at the black-white gap on test scores back in the 1960s, it would have been on the order of 125 to 150 points on a kind of SAT-like test.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's about 70 points, so it's dropped by half. Most of that drop happened in the 70s and early 80s, and there hasn't been a whole lot of progress in the last few decades. Meanwhile, the income gap in academic scores has gone from about 90 points back then to 125 now. So we've seen sort of a reversal in terms of which of those is larger. Now, they're both still large. 70 points on an SAT-like test is still a very big gap. And, you know, it's not to say we don't have a lot of work to do to improve that. But the trend is at least, you know, very slowly in the right direction on the black-white gap, whereas the trend in the gap in achievement between high and low-income kids is going the wrong direction.
Thank you, Flora, for the call. Christine in Rosendale. Hi.
Hi. Good to be on the show. I love hearing about this topic. I'm wondering if the guest is aware of the developmental assets that are put together by the Search Institute.
I'm sorry, the what institute, Christine? I didn't hear you.
Search Institute.
Search Institute.
Basically, it was a large study that was done that found successful kids from all socioeconomic groups, and then what they did is study the difference between the successful kids and the kids that were not successful to find out what the differences were, and they came up with 40 developmental assets. A lot of those are the things that I hear being talked about today, except it really looked at the child in a holistic way. You know, some of it was simply physical things like good nutrition, medical things. Other was a community that surrounded that child, that there were good adult role models, that there were people besides the parents engaged in the child's life. And, you know, I don't remember all of the other groupings, but it seems like a work that would really add to this study, because I think we miss part of it if we only look at one part of the child. It's really important to look at the whole child.
Professor Reardon.
Yeah, great point. And I don't know the work you're citing, but I will look for it. You know, I like the fact that you raised the fact that we should look at other things, because I don't want to come across as sort of saying, well, test scores are the only measure we have of whether kids are thriving. There's some research by Robert Putnam at Harvard, the author of the book Bowling Alone, if you know that.
And, mm-hmm.
and Robert Putnam has been doing work recently, and he shows that there's a widening gap between high and low income children in lots of other kinds of outcomes, like civic engagement, voting behavior, participation in extracurriculars, leadership positions in schools, a lot of the other kinds of things that are signs of kind of thriving, developmentally appropriate kind of activities. And so I'm not just worried because the test score gap is widening, but I'm worried because the gap in lots of other kinds of developmentally appropriate things are widening too. And I'm glad the caller sort of called our attention to those other kinds of things as well.
Thanks, Christine, very much for the call. In the 45 seconds we have left, is there anything that you're calling us to action on, the government, the states, businesses?
You know, I think we ought to think hard about doing a lot more in early childhood to help middle-class and low-income families kind of achieve the same kind of success that high-income families' children are achieving. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't also be thinking a lot about what to do to improve K-12 schooling opportunities for those kids as well.
Mm-hmm. And it's obvious from our conversation that there is a lot to do.
Yes, there is.
Thank you for being with us.
Kathleen, thanks for having me.
Our guest this hour, Professor Sean Reardon. He's a professor of education and sociology at Stanford University. Article with a provocative title, No Rich Child Left Behind, which appeared in the April 27 New York Times. What do you call that section? Week in Review, it used to be. It's Weekly Review. I should know this because I read it every week, and it changed names, and I'll learn. So it's on our Facebook page in case you would like to read it. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this program. Thanks to Lisa Nalbandian for on-air production in our studios here in downtown Milwaukee. We have news coming up momentarily, and we'll return. I think we're going to have a really interesting article because this figure is incredible. 1 in 5 high school age boys diagnosed with ADHD. We'll have lots of calls on that. That's coming up.